Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, November 19th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we have Money and Markets and Ask Catherine, and then Family Wealth, an interview with Jay Hughes, a wonderful author and attorney, and author of the book Family Wealth, much more of a description up on the blog. Our theme tonight is bubble politics, and that's because we're watching, we've been watching for years, a series of ways of printing money accelerated with the bailouts and now with what's called the dollar carry trade to dig us out of debt and derivatives. And, of course, the money is looking for a real place to go, and that's causing all sorts of tensions. It starts with the president's trip to Asia this week, the Southeast Summit in Singapore, and then going to China. China's top chairman of the China Banking Regulatory Commission said that a weak U.S. dollar and low U.S. interest rates, that's part of the U.S. carry trade, has led, quote, to massive speculation, quote, that was inflating asset bubbles around the world. It has created, quote, unavoidable risks for the recovery of the global economy, especially emerging economies, Mr. Liu said. So tension over bubbles. We've seen a lot of commentary to imply that somehow China's going to stop lending us money and that we're at the mercy of the Chinese. Nothing could be further from the truth. I put up on a blog a video done about 3 years ago about space warfare. All of the investment we've shifted to Asia and to China was shifted along with a greater military presence in Middle Asia and in East Asia, and with a very significant investment in satellites and mines. So China and the United States are married at the hip, and they're dealing with many tensions, but they're dealing with a deep dependency on each other. And a competition for natural resources that is going to be much more sort of the elites and the pro-centralization team against everyone else as opposed to sovereign nations against each other. The talk of the Internet in bubble politics this week was a report put out for private clients of a large French bank, Société Générale, called Worst Case Debt Scenario, Protecting Yourself Against Economic Collapse. It's almost 70 pages long and goes into great detail about what investors should do to protect themselves in a worst-case scenario. It has a caveat at the bottom of the report that says, this document is based on an extreme worst-case scenario and does not reflect Société Générale's central scenario. And what they're saying is they're basically helping investors deal with the potential for worst case, but it was quite a significant a document to come out from a fairly mainstream institution. As we keep printing cheap money, there are more signs of inflation, but not in the housing markets. Headline today in the Wall Street Journal is fear of double dip in housing. Now, in Europe, with the Lisbon Treaty passed, the European Union has chosen the Belgian Prime Minister, not Tony Blair, as its first council president. It's going to be interesting to see if an organized EU leadership makes a difference in the situation. What you're seeing here, what you're seeing in Asia, what you're seeing in Europe, is growing reports of unemployment. Unemployment reports continue to grow. We talked about last week going over 10%. They're going to continue to grow, and it's going to be a very significant theme in the geopolitical dance as we watch different countries working together to try and manage the growing unemployment. One of the primary reasons for the unemployment is the financial system literally draining the real economy. And with that in mind, we saw several enormous blunders by Goldman Sachs this week and last week, really at the heart of the issue of all the different things that the financial system is doing, literally to make it impossible for investors, real long-term investors and serious enterprise to get together. The chairman of Goldman Sachs was quoted in a speech as saying that Goldman was doing God's work. The use of the word God set everyone off, including Maureen Dowd and the New York Times, and now has ended up into quite a squabble. She used the story of Jesus and the money changers, so it got quite testy. But then Goldman Sachs came out yesterday and announced a, quote, 10,000 small business initiative where it would donate $500 million, that's a $500 million, of which $200 million would go to educational institutions to help guide business owners. This is so funny. If you're a small business person being reamed by the monetary and fiscal policies that are being engineered very much with the help of Goldman Sachs, you do not have time to go sit down at an educational institution to be guided. So this is sort of funny. And then $300 million invested for lending and philanthropy aimed at community development groups. So you have to go hat in hand to a not-for-profit lender. Anyway, so $500 million, and when you look at the hubris of the whole thing, it's pretty bad. Our hero of the week is Mark Gilbert, who's the London bureau chief for Bloomberg, who wrote as follows about all of this. He describes the fact that Goldman Sachs now has $16.7 billion stashed in its bonus pot for bonuses at the end of the year, which works out to about $500,000 per staffer. But what he says this means, because he compares the two initiatives, both the bonuses to the 10,000 small business philanthropic initiative. He says, what this means is that 10,000 small businesses are worth the equivalent of 1,000 Goldman employees. Alternatively, a Goldmanite's average contribution to society is pitched at the equivalent of 10 small enterprises based on that bonus versus charity calculation. So he goes on to say, the idea that one banker is worth 10 businesses is the kind of math that got us into this mess with finance falsely elevated to become an end in itself rather than a means to providing services to the real economy. The public isn't likely to fall for this charade. The financial community has already spent too many years parading its charitable contributions to help divert attention from its risk-taking adventures. Tax-deductible gestures are no longer sufficient to comfort those who have seen their pension pots devastated by the credit crisis. Even with this year's rally, the total value of the major global stock exchanges is still a bit less than $45 trillion, down from a peak of almost $62 trillion at the end of 2007 before the subprime meltdown wrecked the global economy. Potentially more valuable than the charity fig leaf is the apology, blah, 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 blah. He goes on, and amazingly enough, again, this is a London bureau chief of Bloomberg, he manages to get Matt Taibbi's quote from Rolling Stone into the last paragraph of his article describing Goldman Sachs as, quote, a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. Well, this is an extraordinary development for the media. Some people, however, continue to be focused on what's really important. And so we saw the TARP Inspector General come out with a study on Treasury's gift to AIG and through AIG Goldman Sachs. That came out literally right before the announcement of the $500 million initiatives to help small business. Really unimpressed by these token efforts, there were several calls for Tim Geithner's resignation, and the coup de grace is that the Grayson-Paul Amendment to mandate an audit of the Federal Reserve, remember, Goldman Sachs is a very important player in the New York Fed, which is really the 800-pound gorilla in the Federal Reserve system. So Grayson-Paul Amendment to mandate an audit of Federal Reserve passed the Financial Services Committee today. That means it will be included in the financial regulatory bill that comes out of committee in the House. Now, meantime, the centralization grinds on. Reuters has reported, in fact, everything I've been saying is correct. The Medicare cuts in the health care reform bill are significant. That story is up on the blog. Congress is postponing the energy bill with cap and trade until the spring. Unfortunately, that means they're picking up on the food safety bill. I called my senator yesterday in response to an alert from the Weston Price Foundation saying the Senate means to try and and get the food safety bill passed this year. That's not good. So it seems if they can't get one, there's another. The worst idea of the week was the Department of Justice bringing prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, or plans to bring prisoners from Guantanamo Bay to stand trial for masterminding 9/11. Now, after even years of torture, it's not possible to create a plausible explanation of how these fellows could have gotten the U.S. Air Force to stand down 3 or 4 times in violation of all Air Force protocols. The thought of people who've been through extensive torture then being put on civil trial makes, it's hard to find words to talk about it, but it's not going to be our finest hour. So no gold star for the Department of Justice this week. Okay, that's money and markets. Ask Catherine. Wonderful question from somebody calling themselves a super nerd. Let me pull it out. Myriad factors have caused many people to live a very cloistered life. Minimal human-to-human contact is quite possible at this historical moment. For people with a personal history or temperament that causes them not to trust or interact with others, on and on and on, what can I do? A lot of people feel this way, and if you haven't, I would really encourage you to read the Coming Clean article, which is linked from the homepage, Soleri.com. So if you go to Soleri.com, on the right, you'll see a little block, and it says Coming Clean. It's got a picture of a leaf. And if you go there, it's essentially a response to the question of what can I do. And what you'll see is there are many, many ideas that don't require you to do things in group or do things in an organized fashion. You don't have to start a circle. But there are enormous things that an individual can do to benefit yourself or benefit your community, benefit the economy, benefit others. The important thing to remember when you look at all the various ideas is only do what gives you energy, because the symptom of what is happening is sort of this centralization of everything, is each one of us is being drained. So it's very important that we only do things and we only all of our actions we sequence in a way that gives us energy, because the more energy we get, the more energy we have to do other things. So when you look at that long list, please feel under no obligation to do any one thing. Just do what gives you energy. And if doing it alone is what gives you energy, then absolutely do it that way. Another question. There were several people who were surprised to hear my description last week of the fact that I was not a proponent of the peak oil theory, and also that I thought the odds of collapse were much smaller than the odds of a continued slow burn scenario. And so I just wanted to take a minute to address some of those issues. I have spent many years trying to understand suppressed technology, both particularly in the healthcare area, in the energy area, and very much in weapons and weaponry. And it's extremely hard to find reliable information on it, which is one of the reasons I don't talk about it a lot. If I could find a lot of scientists who were willing to go on the record, it would be much easier to do so. But what I believe is, and it really comes down to who are the scientists I listen to and most trust, I really believe that our dependency on fossil fuel is political, not material. In other words, we have technology and have access to technology which could significantly improve the availability of energy and radically reduce the cost of energy. And, whether it's clean energy or other kinds of technologies, I believe that they exist. I asked you during the Let's Go to the Movie segment, we talked about the documentary Phoenix Lights. One of the reasons I wanted you to watch Phoenix Lights is if you look at the whether it was a spaceship or a hologram, whatever it was that sailed down the side of Arizona in the 90s and was the topic of that documentary, I think it's clear to see when you look at whatever it was, it didn't depend on fossil fuel. And if you look at the technology that the Nazis had with UFOs or the different technology that's come out of that, it's hard to believe that we really need to be dependent on fossil fuel other than as a political matter. So now I say that, and if our cost of energy is skyrocketing, it doesn't matter if it's skyrocketing for material reasons or political reasons. It's skyrocketing. And so I think it's very, very good for people to contemplate the possibility of collapse and contemplate the possibility of radically more or higher costs in energy and other areas of natural resources and essential goods. And so I don't think it hurts us to contemplate the possibility of peak oil, because I think we need, one, to be prepared for higher real prices. But the other thing is, why in the world do we want to be dependent? Even if our dependency in fossil fuel is political, it's still essentially a monopoly dependency. Why would we want to be dependent on central systems? And so I think building local resiliency, whether we're doing it because we're concerned about the politics of the thing or material shortages, is a great idea. And I think it's a great idea not only in a collapse scenario, but in a slow burn scenario. I think the chances of collapse are much smaller than some of the other people I've had on the show, whether it's Dmitry Orlov or Cliff Hyde, people I have great respect for. But I think if you look at the collapses that have occurred around the world and what could occur here, I just think the chances are smaller. And yet if you look at the economics to all of us of a slow burn scenario, building the kind of local resiliency that peak oil causes you to want to build, or a belief in peak oil causes you to build, is a very good idea in slow burn as well. So whether peak oil is true or not, I think the idea of building more resiliency at a local and family and community level is a great idea. Another question I started to answer last week was, how do I tell the truth and stay alive? And last week we talked about two sort of components of how I feel about that. One is I appreciate that I don't know the truth. I'm searching for the truth. And so I'm sharing pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, but I'm trying not to jump to conclusions about who's to blame or what's really going on, because I appreciate that I don't understand everything. The second is, we talked about the red button problem, which is that everyone is really a prisoner of a model that's been going on for centuries, and people that we tend to think of as very powerful are just as much a prisoner of the system as we are, and are very much in a double bind, because the popular support is for the thing that brings the most resources at the cheapest price in the short run to us. The majority of American people do not want the red button pushed, and so that creates a double bind for the leadership. So I try to appreciate that, and when I talk about the truth, I try to talk about responsibilities on a very wide systemic basis. Okay, third idea, and this dovetails with another question I got this week, which is, how do I help my family prepare for essentially a worst-case scenario? It's very important that we use our knowledge to be useful. It's very important, if you look at the people around you in your life, whether it's the people you work with or your family or your friends, everyone that we know is somehow being drained by what's happening. So they're being drained by inflation. They're being hit hard by corruption. They're being hit by unemployment. They're being hit by greater health care problems. And we're also in an aging population. So it's very rare to be around people who are not under some kind of stress. And we need to use our knowledge to give them energy. So one of my favorite stories, I live next to my cousins who are small farmers. And forgive me if you've heard me tell this story before, but my cousin came. So my cousin, she and her husband are cotton farmers, and there's no harder job in the world today than trying to keep a small farm going. And she came in one day and she said, you know, I figured it out. You know what's going to happen, and I want you to just tell me what I should do. Don't tell me why you know. Don't tell me how you know. Just tell me what I need to do. And I understand now that I should just do it and not ask questions. Now, why was she saying that? Because she really doesn't want to know. It's too depressing. It's just too depressing. Some people do want to know. They find it energizing to understand what's going on. Some don't. So try and use your knowledge to help people in a way that's useful to them. And don't try, if you believe the collapse scenario is true, then simply then encourage people to do scenario designing that includes that and find ways of presenting that to them that will show them that there are real economic benefits to it. In, 10 years ago, there weren't a lot of economic benefits from trying to do more for yourself. For most people, now, as financial assets drop in value and tangibles increase in value, there are a lot of benefits to doing it. So things have changed. Another great question, will we put the Solari Report on iTunes? Just to remind everyone, we do a monthly podcast digest called the Solari Report Digest that is available on iTunes. I'd love to get this full Solari Report on iTunes, but that's down the road, so stay tuned. Okay, next, it's a wonderful privilege to introduce this interview to you. Jay Hughes is the author of Family Wealth. I'll introduce him in the tape we're going to play. He was not available to come on live at night, so we pre-recorded him, and we're going to play the tape now. Gary? Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome to the Solari Report Jay Hughes, properly known as James E. Hughes. Jay is a sixth-generation counselor at law. If you read his wonderful book, Family Wealth, Keeping It in the Family, and his now recently published Family, The Compact Among Generations, you'll read a very distinguished history of counselors, many generations. He has written numerous articles on the same subject matter as well as his books. He has practiced law, partnership at two very prestigious New York firms, started his own law firm, and his bio, which is on his website, jamesehughes.com, is lengthy and very, very impressive. So, Jay, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Solari Report.
Thank you, Catherine. I'm absolutely delighted, and hello to all of you who are listening.
One of the things in the introduction to Family Wealth, you describe a period in your life, you're acting as a counselor and attorney to wealthy families, helping them preserve their wealth. And you have kind of a career crisis, but really a sense that you're not doing everything you could to help them. And you kind of go off and have this epiphany that's translated into these wonderful theories and practices that we're going to be talking about today. And maybe if you could describe that real transformation in your work.
Well, Catherine, thank you. You're being very kind. I slammed right into Carl Jung's midlife crisis in exactly the way that Dante Alighieri, in his great poem at the beginning of the Inferno, says that in midlife he found himself in a dark wood with no place to go.
Ooh.
And I was walking along happily, I thought, paying a lot of attention, and one day, in midlife, 49 years old, found myself in a very dark wood with no place to go. And that was both a personal crisis and a sense of my own sense of lack of self-worth, as well as a personal crisis in professional crisis, in the sense that I began to feel that what I was doing harm. And so if you have those two things, I think coming together and converging, you may well find yourself in a dark wood.
Mm. And so what happened?
Well, I guess probably almost everyone who's listening to this has seen Forrest Gump. And basically, after I sat there in that wood and with some wonderful help from friends and people who loved me very much, I began to think that the answer to that problem was to start to read and to try to read all the things I could find that bore on the question of why families over three generations have this creative time, this time of stasis and time of dissipation, and why that suffering occurred, and what I could do about it. And so, like Forrest Gump, where he ran, I read, and I'm very happy to say that I am just about at the end of that reading, a couple thousand books down the road, and like Gump, I'm about to turn around.
One of the things you describe in your introduction is this, you know, this expression of shirt sleeves in three generations, and literally finding that this is a global phenomena in many, many cultures.
Yes, this particular proverb, the Chinese expresses rice paddy to rice paddy in three generations, and of course, for those of us who have ever seen a person bent over pulling rice in water, it doesn't feel good when you start, and you certainly wouldn't be happy to end up back there.
Uh-huh.
The Irish clogs to clogs. Every culture on earth, Catherine, and I have been just about everywhere, not everywhere, but almost everywhere, I have run into this proverb in some form. It's in the Bible. It showed up in Peter Bernstein's wonderful book about risk against the gods.
Uh-huh.
It's the human condition.
It's almost like the inflation we experience in the financial world is an entropy that we experience in the family, and in the family's preservation of wealth.
It is, and it's also like physics, for those who are interested in that, in the sense that in this remarkable, wonderful universe of energy, things materialize. A lot of Nobel Prizes will be won if people can figure out how. And then, sadly, through that process of entropy, that process of friction, decay, however you like it, everything material eventually goes back to being energy. And so these families are following out that same universal truth of something being created, something being sort of an ecstatic state, and then falling back to energy. The difference is that I think somehow when rocks become material and go back to being energy, I don't think the same level of suffering is present.
Right. Right. Well, the question that you ask in the beginning of Family Wealth is, and let me just read it, can a family successfully preserve its wealth for more than 100 years or for at least four generations? And you posit a theory, and we have, let's see, seven aspects to that theory. Let me just go through them with you. The first is preservation of long-term family wealth is a question of human behavior.
Yes, and let me say that as the years have gone by, since I wrote the book that you're quoting from, Family Wealth, Keeping It in the Family, I only feel more confirmed. I never believe something because I'm sure I'll be surprised tomorrow, but I feel more and more confirmed that it is human behavior, and particularly the growth of the critical asset of a family, and that is its human beings, and how they learn and grow that really matters, how they behave, in a sense, together.
Then the second is wealth preservation is a dynamic process of group activity or governance that must be successfully re-energized in each successive generation to overcome the threat of entropy.
Yes, and the key word here is dynamic. One of the problems of all systems that I've encountered, human systems, is that when they begin, they are also often, I should say, a response to a problem, and we find a function, a way as a group to function to resolve that problem. Over time, they tend to become forms. And when something moves from function to form, it gets into terrible trouble, because form... I'm doing this on purpose. It's a little fun on the radio. Form must follow function. So dynamic governance is a function. It's a dynamic function. It's a growing function. It keeps maturing and changing in the decision-making process to meet the new challenges.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as it's just governance, It doesn't have that word dynamic before it. Unfortunately, the process of decay and entropy is at work.
Right. Right. And it's interesting. So many families that I know don't even envision creating a kind of governance system or making the investment process explicit together. In other words, there's a whole investment in the family as a risk management and investment unit that has gotten lost, literally.
Yeah, and this is where we have broken away in modernity, I think, from our sense of all of our teachers that family is the one place in which our individual identity has the greatest chance of being shared and the most secure place in most cases. Not all cases, but most cases. And why do we, what is family? Well, first Webster says it has to be two or more people. You can have a single person household, but you cannot have a single person family. And so if it is two or more persons, then immediately you have a joint decision-making process. And as I've said to many families over the years as an example, when you have a mother and the infant, an infant makes all the decisions. They're still joint. But every what is governance? Make it as simple as it actually is. Governance is simply a description of a joint decision-making process. So if you have family and the purpose for the family is to try to exist beyond the Proverbs prognostication of three generations so that human beings will continue to thrive, you have to make joint decisions. And that's what governance is. It is really just joint decisions. I didn't say just in the sense of easy. I said that is what it is.
Right. Embedded, though, is an intention, I think, that if families even just realize that they can help each other build wealth together and that building wealth requires that kind of cooperation and families can be powerful at it, that's a very important realization and intention for a family to create together.
Yes, and that is a borders, if not in the spiritual dimension.
Yes.
The Buddha said, and most of the great traditions have said, that all successful action must be grounded first in right intention. And right intention is that deep sense that we have a common purpose, and the common purpose is to help each other achieve our highest capacity in this lifetime and to seek to help each other. Without that intention, the proverb will simply prove itself true.
You mean the not the Buddhist, the shirt sleeve?
You got it.
Yeah. the third aspect of the theory is one of my favorite. The assets of a family are its individual members.
Yes, and it is so strange to me that illusion that a family is its financial capital is overwhelmingly common. Of course it isn't. What is a family? The family are its individual members. But this illusion that it is its financial capital is entropic at the core.
Yes, and this is something I struggle with my clients with all the time. I have to keep saying, you're the asset, not your financial wealth. In other words, the money, as you describe it, is a tool to support you and your highest purpose. And obviously we need the money to work and we want the money to grow, but you are the asset, not your money.
Yes, and another thing, Catherine, just to touch on this, one of the problems often, I mean very, very often, is that the emphasis in family is on the wealth creator who becomes a heroine or heroine, almost a heroic figure, when in fact the financial capital is simply the representation of the successful living out of a dream.
Right.
One of the great problems for the second and third generation is that cognitively no one can ever dream another's dream that we're not given as a species.
Right.
So if we fail to perceive that the creative act was the dreaming, not the money,
right,
then we fail to understand what the hero or heroine's journey actually was.
Right.
And if we can understand that, and so we can see that family is about the bringing to life of each of our dreams, as long as they don't harm us or harm someone else, then we're about the creative act that is generative.
Right, and so the success of one dream then supports and encourages the success of many, and it's that combination that makes the family powerful.
It is, and the tragedy, and it is a tragedy so common in many of these families, is that this they understand profoundly in their philanthropy and spend endless wonderful hours bringing the dreams to life of strangers, which is a wonderful work, while becoming entirely trapped by the financial capital and dream of the first generation, and they themselves never bring their own dream to life.
Oof.
This is a tragedy of the commons in this field.
Well, you know, to me, Jay, it's a tragedy not just of families that have built wealth, but of the families who would like to build wealth and can't.
It is, and if we concentrate on dreams, and we concentrate on the common purpose of seeking to help each other bring our dreams to life and enhancing, in that sense, enhancing each other's journeys of happiness, we have a common purpose around which we can all make joint decisions.
Well, that we're talking now about the fourth aspect. Let me read it. The wealth of a family consists of the human and intellectual capital of its members. A family's financial capital is a tool to support the growth of the family's human and intellectual capital.
Yes, who are we? As I said earlier in one of your questions, the family is the human beings that make it up. What are they? They are a combination of their interior gifts as human beings, their dreams, their physical selves, and what they know and can learn and can share. That is the human journey.
Yeah.
Financial capital is a function of the result of someone's dream, and it can be wonderfully helpful as a tool, no different than a hammer or a saw.
Right.
But if one says, that is what I am, somebody else's dream, materialization,
uh-huh.
You will find yourself in Dante's dark wood.
One of the... I'm always big on learning metabolisms, and the learning metabolisms of families or communities or organizations. And, you know, you have some great stories in family wealth, like the stories of the Rothschilds,
yep.
The original patriarch who got all of his sons to live in five different cities and write letters. It's a little bit like the British Empire. You write a letter once a month talking about what's going on in your place. And you know, the increased learning and the sharing combined with the intention combined with the skills over long periods of time, both the trust and the competency, and that's what starts to compound and build the wealth, you know, sort of greater than the rate of inflation.
Absolutely it does, Catherine. The whole of history, in some historians' minds, is the history of advances in transportation and communication. And it's a very, I'm not overly simplifying a subject that is infinitely complex, but certainly in family, increased communication in the intellectual sense and increased communication in the human and emotional senses are where capital grows. And
right.
Financial capital can support the growth of those two, but if it's the only capital, the family has no chance.
Right. Right. One of the things I love is you mentioned the importance of going international, of the family speaking different languages, of understanding what's going on in the different parts of the world through intimate experience. And, you know, it's a very strategic way of thinking about building your family forward.
Well, it is, and again, this is the, again, interestingly, questions of transportation and communication.
Yeah.
Putting yourself at risk, within risks that you understand, or at least many of them, and taking an adventure with the risks that you know you haven't fully understood, means using transportation and communication, whether it's through new language, through different vehicles. Adventure, using my metaphor, is how we grow our human selves and our intellectual selves. And all the great stories we love are really stories of adventure, aren't they? At some level.
Yeah,
some are adventure.
That's true.
Interior, some are interior journeys, some are exterior journeys. They're all, but the point is that we grow our human selves and our intellectual selves when we're prepared to take an adventure. And one of the things that I ask the families, the few now that I serve since I'm retired, but I ask them very often, the 50s and 60-year-olds, not just the 13s and 20-year-olds, have you ever had an adventure?
And what did they say?
Many of them say no. Because
oh, my word.
Because they were living, stewarding someone else's dream.
Oh.
No one ever asked them, well, do you have a dream? Do you have an adventure to go on? And so they're very sad people. They have lots of money. They have big houses. They live a large life. But when you ask them that question, like little children, very sophisticated people, they're very sad. And they say, no, I never have.
Well, it's never too late to have an adventure.
I'm sorry?
It's never too late to have an adventure.
Never. And how do we know ourselves if we've never ventured?
I know. Well, the last three aspects of the theory involve two things, shared values and governance. And I was wondering if you could just say a little bit, how do you get your family, because Jay, I've tried to do this, and so I don't want to be a hypocrite because I've had mixed results. How do you persuade your family to get together and sort out what their shared values are and create a system of governance that could be a wealth-building process?
Well, if I knew that question, I would be a happy man because I could help a lot more people, Catherine. I'll offer a couple of thoughts. The one thing that we share in our as a species, we're in this form the anthropologists and biologists tell us about 190,000 years. Whether we believe it or not, but that's at least someone's guess. What has been the shared human experience of how we know what it is to be human and how we know what our lineage is? It is telling stories. We are today, as we have always been, the product of our oral tradition. Writing's about 6,000 years old and is a fine communication device. But it has the odd effect that you don't hear the hearer. You have to try to create listening through the page. On the other hand, what do we love to do most in family is hear our stories.
Yeah.
Now, nobody else is going to be much interested in that, just as they are not interested in our summer vacation flick as a family. But we will watch that movie over and over. We will hear Grandma's stories over and over. We know the punchlines. We know the outcomes, but we're always surprised.
Uh-huh.
Because this is to be human. Well, when you begin that process of storytelling and you really have a tradition of the storytelling, all the values of your family come out as those stories are told.
Right, that's true. You rediscover who we are. Who are we?
Yes.
Right.
And then we know where we're going. We have to know where we've come from, I believe, to know where we're going. And it is in storytelling, real storytelling. So, for instance, when I was first coming out of the dark wood and I was beginning to imagine some of the practical things, that I might be able to help a family do to grow its human intellectual capital, to find a way of governing itself, to make some joint decisions, it occurred to me to look at the agendas of the family meetings. And to my horror, I found that the agendas were basically the agendas that had only to do with the financial capital. There was no game playing. There was no storytelling. There was no report of the rising young adults, no report from the elders of what they were finding. There was just concentration on the financial capital. And, of course, then what I discovered was that those agendas were made entirely by the people who were responsible for the financial capital and were fascinated by it. And I could then understand why they got such poor attendance. So hitting myself upside the head, and I thought to myself, well, I'm going to be adventuresome. I'm going to ask some of these families that were asking if I could help them, well, suppose half of the agenda still was on the financial matters, because those are important stewarding and conservating questions, but suppose the other half had to do with storytelling and had to do with reports from the youth of their dreams and reports from the elders of their experiences, and suppose we tried that. Well, to my amazement, and I have to say I was amazed, we began to get 100% attendance.
Wow!
Now, that did not mean that people felt that they needed to get on their BlackBerries when the financial reports were being made.
Uh-huh.
But for the 50% of the meeting that was actually about them, it was 100% attendance.
One of the ideas you talk about in the book that I love is the idea of the family bank.
Yeah.
Because to this day, I am shocked to see the extent to which, you know, whether it's families of modest means or very wealthy, are, you know, we're investing in large entities far, far away and not cycling money within the family, you know, venture hopes of the kids or, you know, somebody's in trouble gifting money. You know, there's a lot of circulation that could be going on that could build up the human and intellectual capital and even the business capital of the family. But we're not thinking that way. We're not thinking about how is our family and our family network an opportunity. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about the family bank, because I just love that idea.
Well, my father, who had his great qualities, he was a great lawyer, and also his infirmities, as all of us do. But one day when my youngest sister was turning 21, he called me aside at her college graduation and he said, Jay, I want you to tell your younger brother and two younger sisters that your mother and I are now a bank. He said, Dad, we're not bankers. You're a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. We've had five generations. What do you mean we're not bankers? He said, yep. We said, well, just tell them that we're a bank and the bank window's open. So I said, well, I thought to myself, I think I will be tardy about that one, which was another thing he taught me, how to be tardy in the best way. That is when I didn't know what I was doing, not to just rush ahead and do it. So a few weeks later, I sat down with him again. I said, Dad, I've been pondering this. I've been tardy. I didn't tell. He said, oh, that's all right. But I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, look. He said, your mother and I had a dream. We started out from two Depression-era families, totally one bankrupt and the other might just as well have been. Your mother and I have been major savers and really worked hard to save. And our basic goal, our dream, in fact, was for the four of you to have college educations. Well, that's complete. And we still have enough capital. Now, he said, I'm not talking about spending the capital your mother and I need to live as gentlefolks however long they've lived, and one lived to 92 and mom's still alive at 90.
Wow.
He said, I'm talking about the extra. And he said, it's not huge. I practiced law and I saved. I didn't, wasn't venturesome. He said, basically, my thought is that to grow a great family, which is your mother's and my really big dream, if the four of you as siblings and your spouses will look to the bank for loans or grants that will be made by all of us together. So you need to put in a business plan and you need to make a request and we'll gather and we'll ask you questions. We'll try to help you with it. We'll offer our human and intellectual help with it. And then if financial capital is needed, we will try to support it. And he said, in that sense, we are a family bank. Well, I can only say homage to my father and mother, that has, for our family, been one of the great binding ideas. And similarly, for many families that I've helped, a binding idea. And not to go on too far, but just to say, just last night, I was reading a book about a remarkable life's journey of a great adventurer. And lo and behold, his story is a story that when opportunity came, he went to the banks, he went to friends, no one could help, and finally he went home to his mother and to the jar. This was an immigrant family and immigrated out to the South Asia. And they had a jar, and what that family's tradition was that if they had a few extra coins or a few extra pounds or dollars, they would put it in this jar. And if you needed it, you took it out and just left a note that you'd done so, and if you were able later on, you put it back. And it was in from that family bank, that jar, that he had the funds to go on and create what is today one of the world's greatest fortunes.
It's amazing. When I look at the entrepreneurs I know who've done incredible things, again and again and again, you come back to the financing and the support they receive from their families. And it's, you know, it's probably the most critical form of venture capital in this country.
It absolutely is. And that same gentleman in this book speaks to each of his children every day.
Wow!
And because, as he said, being a Holocaust survivor, family is everything.
Right. If you know, it's funny when you describe the family bank, what you're describing is creating a really powerful constituency to help you get smart, stay smart, and with all the practical aspects of you know, starting something and being successful, including the financing. And it's a, you know, to me it's a way of thinking, and it's a way of thinking that if a family can do it, becomes really powerful.
I can think of no more practical and useful thing, and I do want to say that the most important assets in that bank are the human and intellectual capital of those who hold an interest in the bank.
Right, and that's why I also want, you have a lovely section on the role of aunts and uncles, and I am, it's really cousins, I'm sort of play aunt to two of my cousins here,
mm-hmm.
And so it resonated very deeply, so I wanted you to just mention that if you could.
Well, first, the role of aunts and uncles in modernity has fallen away, at least in a good part of America, because we all move so often. The closeness that existed. This is somewhat of a tragedy because aunts and uncles share the same DNA with us as our parents.
Yeah.
They are the only other biological creatures and psychological creatures who have the same investment in our success as our parents, with the one great advantage over our parents that they can be objective. I haven't met an objective parent. Perhaps you're one, but I'm not.
I've never met one.
Aunts and uncles have a certain degree of objectivity that the parents don't have. So one of the tragedies of modernity is that we have lost the closeness to aunts and uncles that they will naturally have for us. Now, that doesn't mean we all like each other. I'm not saying that. But we start out with the probability that our aunts and uncles will have a fundamental interest in us, particularly if we're lucky enough to have a maiden aunt or a bachelor uncle.
Mm-hmm.
Who decides that maybe we are, in some sense, their biological heirs.
Mm-hmm.
In my life, my father's single sister, just the one sibling, was a maiden lady, and she was of enormous importance to me and to my brother and sisters as we grew up. She was the one who remembered the holidays when mom was legitimately way over taxed with four kids. She was the one who showed up in Halloween with the false faces. She was the one at Christmas who showed up with the very odd candy that we weren't supposed to have. She was the one who showed up all of the times, and always with a poem, because she was a poetess. I think one cannot overestimate the value of aunts and uncles if we can take the time to really get to know our nieces and nephews well. I will say personally, in addition to my aunt, that I have been blessed, again, since the dark wood. I didn't really know this before that. Blessed that at this stage of my life, I've actually gotten to Reno all my nephews and nieces, and it's been one of the most joyful experiences I have ever had.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. You know, the one last thing that I wanted to make sure we touched on is I've spent a lot of time trying to understand the economics of communities, and right now I'm working on a game as to help people invest in their community. And I've come down to I was working with the designers of the game, and I pointed something out to them which they didn't realize. I said, look, it's very simple. If you want a successful community, then you have to build great families that have, you know, that are financially successful. You know, if you get, it's as a design metric, you know, if you take a community where there are two families that, you know, that are successful, and you can get 20 families that are successful, you're going to have a much more successful community. It's almost that simple. And so I think when we talk about the preservation of family wealth, you know, many people don't realize we're also talking about the building of great communities.
Well, we are. And if I may end with the great philosopher of human communities, it was Aristotle. In Aristotle's great book, The Politics, he makes the point that the building block of every community is rock-solid families. You can't have a society larger than the family if the family building block of that society is not strong and well-bonded, as is necessary with all good structures. So every society is what? It is built up of the families that make it up. If they are weak, you've built on sand, and that society will go away with the tide. If families are strong, if they're growing their human and intellectual selves, they're enhancing each other's journeys of happiness, they have a common purpose, they grow the financial capital because they learn to be good stewards, which is a process you can only learn if you're a thriving human intellectual self. You have a strong family, it joins with other strong families, and surprise, surprise, you have a very strong community.
That's
absolutely, absolutely fundamental.
Yep.
And you can't change it. Aristotle talked about it in 400-something B.C., or 300-something B.C., but anyway, a long time.
And we're still trying to figure out how to get it to work on the ground. Well, Jay, it's been absolutely a pleasure. Maybe if you could just take a minute or two and describe how can we stay current with your work. If you could describe your website and just how we stay in touch, how we stay in cahoots.
Yes. Well, as you were kind enough to mention before, my website is jameshughes.com. And you will find on that site, Catherine and fellow friends who are listening, a series of reflections which I've been writing parallel to my books on specific subjects that three or more families ask me about. So I have a rule that until three families, independent of each other, ask me the same question, I probably don't write about it. But if I get three, there's something in that magic triangle that tells me, well, there might be worth something, it might be worth saying something about that. And so from time to time, I add to those reflections. And so I would suggest that that's probably the place where you will find whatever new thinking I am doing. And beyond that, I can only say that I hope everyone who's listening will not suffer shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves, but rather grow great families and prosper mightily in doing so.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You're
have a wonderful
welcome.
Day.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Jay. So, Jay Hughes, Family Wealth is his first book. I strongly recommend it. If you're looking for a Christmas present to give to all the members of your family, there it is, Family Wealth. Get the conversation going. There's no, we have no Let's Go to the Movies tonight. Our next movie is going to be on December 10th. It's Royal Rife, The Forgotten Story. I mention it to you now because it is, it's not available at Netflix. It's not available at the video stores. You're going to need to buy it online. If you do a search, you can get it. It's a marvelous documentary. It's well worth purchasing. It's a classic for your DVD and video library. It will teach you more about the healthcare debate and the healthcare bill and healthcare than all the articles written this year put together. If you understand the story of Royal Rife and what he accomplished and the fact that his technology is as a practical matter, not available today, it says more than I can possibly say about healthcare and how we need to look at it. So with that, have a wonderful Thanksgiving. We won't be with you next week. We'll be back on December 4th with Terry Cullen, Protecting Yourself from Identity Theft. She wrote the Wall Street Journal book on protecting yourself from identity theft. Then December 10th, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. The precious metals market continues to be at the heart of the storm that gathers. So until December 4th, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. I have a lot to give thanks for over Thanksgiving. And, you know, at the very top of my list, I give thanks for having you in my life. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the opportunity to do this Solari Report and have you as subscribers. So until December 4th, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.